Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You were made to travel the world and the seven seas and countless lakes and innumerable rivers and one perfect pond. Get travel ideas from ChatGPT on Expedia. Made to travel.
With Dash Pass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with Dash Pass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 27th of February, these are our main stories. The last barrier to Sweden becoming a member of NATO has been lifted, with Hungary finally giving its approval. The US Supreme Court is hearing arguments about social media companies that could transform the way we use the internet. 10 days after his unexpected death, an ally of the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny says he was about to be freed in a prisoner exchange. Also in this podcast...
And here's this letter with the tiniest writing imaginable, and it starts off...
The woman at the centre of a love triangle between the Beatles star George Harrison and guitarist Eric Clapton is selling their letters to her. The final obstacle to Sweden's bid to join NATO has been cleared after Hungary's parliament voted to accept its membership. Sweden will now become the organisation's 32nd member after its neighbour Finland joined last year in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The Swedish Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, called it a historic day and said his country stood ready to shoulder its security responsibilities. The NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg, said Sweden's accession would help the alliance face the growing threat from Russia.
It makes NATO stronger, Sweden safer, and all of us more secure. It also demonstrates that NATO's door is open, that President Putin did not succeed in his attempt to close NATO's door.
As our correspondent Caroline Hawley reports, it's been a bumpy road for Sweden, which had to overcome opposition from not just one, but two NATO members to join the alliance.
A vote in Hungary's parliament this afternoon, a moment Sweden has been waiting for nearly 2 years. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine prompted the Nordic country to abandon 2 centuries of military non-alignment. But 2 countries stood in Sweden's way, Turkey and Hungary, both closer to Russia than other members of the US-led alliance. Turkish anger about Kurdish militants given refuge in Sweden was assuaged when tougher anti-terrorism laws were passed in Stockholm. But that still left Hungary, its nationalist government, upset by Swedish criticism of its democratic standards. Today, the Prime Minister Viktor Orbán addressed Parliament.
Tisztelt Országgyűlés! Magyarország kormánya a képviselők elé terjesztette Svédország NATO csatlakozását.
He asked it to vote in favour of Sweden joining NATO. It duly did, 3 days after the Swedish Prime Minister visited Budapest and a deal was done for Hungary to buy 4 warplanes from Sweden. Robert Dahlscher of the Swedish Defence Research Agency said his country would bring NATO its modern air force and submarines specially adapted to the Baltic Sea. And it would gain security, supported by US nuclear deterrence.
We did not have the wherewithal to stand up to Russia if there would be a real fight or if they would choose to pressure us really hard. And the war in Ukraine has shown that only treaty allies are covered by the security guarantee. And thus we needed to come in under the umbrella.
NATO will now have control over almost the entire Baltic Sea. It will also have 32 members, another expansion of the alliance which Vladimir Putin had said his invasion of Ukraine aimed to stop.
Caroline Hawley. Social media has dramatically changed our lives. Now the US Supreme Court is hearing arguments in 2 cases that could dramatically reshape online platforms. The judges are considering whether the Republican-controlled states of Texas and Florida should have the power to decide what posts social media platforms can remove from their services. Our US business correspondent, Michelle Fleury, explained how these cases had ended up coming before the Supreme Court.
You have to go back to the siege on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. After that, President Donald Trump at the time was barred from Facebook, Twitter and YouTube. And in response to that, Florida enacted a law that made it illegal for technology companies to ban from their sites a candidate for office in the state. In other words, if there was any political candidate on the site, their content couldn't be blocked. And the same in Texas. They passed a law which banned the platforms from taking down political content. In part, this was in reaction to what many Republicans have alleged has been sort of a censorship by Silicon Valley on more conservative views. And now what's happened is, as this has worked its way through challenges in the courts, it's ended up before the nation's highest court, who must now decide what people in America can hear, say, and read online.
And when are we expecting a decision, and what could its impact be?
We expect the court will take a couple of months. So people are saying June might be when we get it. And that is a crucial time if you think of the election cycle and the upcoming presidential election. The decision could be pretty explosive because it is a test of the First Amendment in the digital era and kind of how it applies to the internet. You have attorneys for these states defending the laws, saying that they simply want to be able to regulate businesses, not their speech. But then you've got those who are challenging the law, including a tech industry group called NetChoice, who say, look, you're violating or infringing the First Amendment rights of these businesses, which is to publish content as they see fit and without being told what they can't or can't do by the government.
And assuming that the US Supreme Court rules in favour of these Republican-controlled states, could this have an impact outside the United States?
Well, I mean, I think if you imagine that the ruling goes against these tech giants, there is concern, or at least the argument that they've been making in front of the justices today, is that it would have ramifications for their business models, that the curation is crucial to attracting users and advertisers. And they gave examples of sites like Etsy, which is popular with crafters, saying if you don't filter what sites are presented to users, it can become unmanageable, unwieldy, and it would make their businesses less successful. And so I think that's where you can see a ripple effect more broadly, not just in the US, but internationally. On the flip side of this, if the ruling goes against the states who made these laws, there is an argument of then, well, how hard is it to rein in and to regulate these tech companies? And that's certainly the argument the attorneys are making. It'll be interesting to see what EU regulators, which in many ways have been doing a better job of regulating these tech giants than we've seen the US regulators do.
Michelle Fleury. Was Alexei Navalny about to be freed as part of a Russian prisoner swap when he unexpectedly died in the penal colony where he was being held? That's a claim being made by a close colleague of Mr. Navalny's. Maria Pevchik says the opposition leader was going to be exchanged for a Russian hitman who's currently serving a life sentence for murder in Germany. In a video posted on YouTube, she said that in the end, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, could not bear the thought of his most high-profile opponent being freed.
Navalny was everything Putin won't ever become, and Putin hated him for that. Why did he kill Navalny right now? Why the 16th of February? Navalny should have been freed in the following days, because in early February, Putin proposed a swap between an FSB officer and a hitman, Vadim Krasikov, who is in prison in Berlin, for two US nationals and Alexei Navalny.
The Russia editor of BBC Monitoring, Vitaly Shevchenko, told us more about the claim being made by Mr. Navalny's ally.
Maria Pevchik is a key associate of Alexei Navalny, or was, and she said that the night before Mr. Navalny died, she had been told that negotiations about his swap had reached the final stage. That's the wording that Ms. Pevchik used. According to her, Alexei Navalny and two unnamed US nationals were to be exchanged for somebody called Vadim Krasikov, who is a Russian Secret Service assassin currently serving a life sentence in Germany. And then, according to Ms. Pevchuk, President Putin did something irrational. He had Alexei Navalny killed in jail. That's the allegation coming from his team and his relatives.
And how credible is this allegation? Was anyone else talking about a possible prisoner exchange?
Well, interestingly, President Putin himself, when he spoke in an interview with Tucker Carlson, the US media personality, earlier this month, he hinted at the possibility of exchanging Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter currently in detention in Russia, exchanging him for Vadim Krasikov, the FSB assassin. So this remark by the Russian president gives some credence to what Ms. Pevchuk said. Having said that, we still have no idea what exactly happened to Alexei Navalny in jail. According to his spokesperson, Kira Yarmush, apparently the official investigation into his death concluded that he died of natural causes, and few people among his supporters are inclined to believe it. But the bottom line is that we don't really know what happened to Mr. Navalny.
And the Kremlin denies that anything underhand happened. Some might ask, why would President Putin allow a prisoner exchange only to kill Alexei Navalny at the last minute?
We have to remember that President Putin is a former KGB officer. And as such, it's not unreasonable to assume that he would be used to saying one thing and then doing another thing. And if we are to believe Maria Pevchuk, President Putin hated Alexei Navalny so much that he absolutely rejected the very idea of seeing him walk free.
Vitaly Shevchenko, an Iranian pop singer who encouraged women to break the country's headscarf law, has had his more than two-year jail sentence commuted to home confinement. Mehdi Yarahi's lawyer said the court took the decision because of his client's health problems. Mr. Yarahi was arrested in August for releasing the song called Your Headscarf, shortly before the anniversary of the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, who was detained for not covering her hair 2 years ago. Mike Thompson reports.
Take off your scarf, the sun is sinking, sings Mehdi Yarahi, and let your hair flow. Words dedicated, he said, to the courageous Iranian women. Not exactly the message the Iranian authorities wanted broadcast, either then or now. Fearing it might reignite the nationwide protests following Mahsa Amini's death, Mr. Yarahi was arrested and later jailed. But with the street protests now largely faded, the rebellious songsmith's jail term has been commuted to house arrest, an electronic tag, and presumably a ban on singing a certain song.
That report by Mike Thompson. Now to a bit of rock history. She inspired some of the most memorable songs of the 1960s and 70s. Something by George Harrison. And I say yes, you look wonderful tonight. And You Look Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton, who pursued the model Patti Boyd while she was still married to the Beatles star before eventually marrying her himself. Now the former model and muse is selling letters that lift the lid on her infamous love triangle with the two musicians. Our music correspondent is Mark Savage.
Patti Boyd was a model first, and she really epitomised the swinging 60s scene in London. She had this long, straight blonde hair and these beautiful almond eyes. You would see her down Carnaby Street and Mary Quant dressed her and talked her, who then moved into becoming a photographer as well. So very, very much part of that 60s scene. She met George Harrison on the set of the Beatles film A Hard Day's Night in 1964, and she said they instantly felt a connection because they were both quite shy. She was credited with kind of expanding his worldview. She went to India with him for those famous trips that the Beatles took, and he wrote dozens of songs about her, most famously Something in the Way She Moves, which he recorded with the Beatles. But at the same time, one of George Harrison's best friends, Eric Clapton, had his eye on George Harrison's wife, and he was writing her these incredibly passionate declarations of love that would be delivered to their mansion in Surrey while George Harrison was away on tour or in the recording studio, and she had to decide what she was going to do.
And ultimately, she did end up divorcing George Harrison and marrying Eric Clapton later on. So given the importance these letters must have to her, why has she decided to auction them now? What is she auctioning exactly?
Well, it's not just the letters that were sent to her by Eric Clapton, but also love letters that George Harrison wrote. But she said that she's kept them all these years and she'd looked back at them when she was writing her autobiography a couple of years ago, and they still cause her a lot of heartache. And so I think she's decided that maybe it would be best if they were made public. So not only is she selling them, but you can now read them on the Christie's website. They're going to be put on display before they're auctioned off in London later this month. And on the Christie's website, actually, she's posted a video describing why she's parting ways with all of this memorabilia, but also rather beautifully reading that first letter that she got from Eric Clapton.
And here's this letter with the tiniest writing imaginable. And it starts off, "I'm writing this note to you with the main purpose of ascertaining your feelings towards a subject well known to both of us. Oh, my love, E."
And Mark, even though both Patty Boyd's marriages ended in divorce, the two men concerned remained on friendly terms.
Yes, and even when she married Eric Clapton, and I think we have to stress there's a gap of almost 8 years between her divorcing George Harrison and getting together with Eric Clapton and marrying him. They married with George Harrison's blessing. And in fact, at one point in the 1990s, the two men appeared on stage together and duetted, singing Something, the song that George Harrison had originally written for her. And George Harrison called Eric Clapton his husband-in-law. So in, I guess, what is kind of a very 60s way, there was a lot of peace and love about it. And they came to terms with the fact that they had both shared a love with this wonderful woman.
Mark Savage. Still to come in this podcast, the Indian runaway train that travelled for 70 kilometres without a driver.
The Global Story helps make sense of the headlines with expert analysis from BBC journalists around the world.
Social media has essentially siloed a lot of young men and women into different algorithmic bubbles.
Men and women inhabiting the same environment in the real world, but very different ones online.
One Global Story at a time, in detail, every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
For those Russians who sympathise with Alexei Navalny, it will cast a very dark shadow.
This looks like a message.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
David taught himself how to make bread. Good bread. He wanted to get even better, so he asked ChatGPT on Expedia if there's such a thing as a bread vacation. ChatGPT said, sure. Do you want to go to Normandy, Morocco, Ireland, or Tuscany? And that's how David became a master pizzaiolo. You were made to learn new things. We were made to give you trip ideas with ChatGPT right in our app. Expedia, made to travel.
Wherever you are on your well-being journey, Audible is there for you. You'll discover voices that motivate to spark you to take action.
The best time to start is right now.
There are sounds to soothe, so you can focus, reduce stress, and sleep better. Stories to inspire, so you can dream big again.
One liftoff.
And a range of personalities, so you'll have a partner on your journey. Get closer to the best you with bestsellers, new releases, and exclusive originals, all ad-free. Listen now on Audible.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. It's arguably the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with thousands of people killed and millions more forced to flee. But it's also been described as the forgotten war, as international attention has focused on Gaza and Ukraine. The civil war in Sudan that broke out 10 months ago has unleashed many horrors, widespread rape and torture, even the beheading of students. Many of those who fled have tried to enter Egypt. It has tried to stem the flow by imposing visa restrictions, But as BBC Arabic's Mohammed Osman reports, that's forced the desperate refugees into the clutches of people smugglers.
It's 1,000 kilometres from North Sudan to Cairo across the dry Sahara. The landscape is harsh and unforgiving and the journey long. But thousands of Sudanese are risking the dangers to flee fighting at home. BBC Arabic has spoken to Sudanese refugees making the crossing into Egypt, facilitated by people smugglers who charge high rates and can't guarantee safety. Halima, who doesn't want to give her real name, is one of many who've risked everything to leave her country. After fighting escalated in her home state, she and her daughter decided their only chance was to try to reach Cairo. They had hoped to travel legally, but they couldn't afford the Egyptian visas. So instead, they put their faith in people smugglers. It was a dangerous decision. Halima describes what happened after her daughter was beaten by bandits.
They shot in the air and told us to get out of the car quickly. One of them slapped her and snatched the earrings out of her ears. I told him not to hit her, just take the earrings. Also, they took the money from the rest of the families we were with.
Like Halima, Ibtissam, who also doesn't want to give her real name, tried to cross into Egypt with the help of smugglers.
For 3 days, we had no food or water. We ran out of clean water and had to drink water which had been mixed with gasoline from bottles in the car. We had no choice but to give this to the children too. We were tired of suffering and the children cried.
Most trips into Egypt start in the gold mining area of northern Sudan. The smugglers are often gold miners who charge as much as $300 for each person they take across. Arriving in Cairo, the Sudanese apply for refugee status with the UN. UNHCR spokesperson Christine Bishai says her organization can only do so much with limited resources.
We have expanded our capacity by 900%. Of course, we realize that people's needs are very large, greater than our ability to cover them. There are priorities. Who is most in need? Anybody who has a problem during the trip, we try and provide them life-saving support. So there are clinics where we provide medical service at the border through the Red Crescent.
Halima says that the stress of the attack was so great that when they eventually reached Cairo, her daughter fell ill.
She felt short of breath. They put her on an oxygen device and she went into intensive care. Then she died.
For the Sudanese who make it safely into Egypt as recognized refugees, this is only the beginning. They now have to face the difficult task of rebuilding their lives. For the moment, any hope of going home is remote as the fighting continues with no end in sight.
That report by Mohammed Osman on the plight of Sudanese refugees. Like many technology giants, Google has been developing its own version of artificial intelligence called Gemini. It has an image generation feature. You tell it what you want it to draw. But Gemini has had a rough few days. It didn't take long for people to discover that it somehow appeared curiously progressive. When asked for a picture of the US founding fathers, it produced men and women with different skin colours. Google have pulled that particular product, but it's raised the question as to how far AI reflects values imposed on it by its creators. The BBC's technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, explains the conundrum that Google finds itself in.
What Google is trying to do is to correct a really old problem, which is that there has traditionally been so much bias expressed, you know, accidentally or not, but mainly accidentally by products over time. For example, you know, if you Google pictures of doctors, you're more likely to get loads of pictures of men. If you Google pictures of babies, you're more likely to get lots of pictures of white babies. And we know that artificial intelligence is only as good as the data that it's trained on. And if it's being trained on data of, you know, thousands of pictures of doctors and they all look like men, then if you ask it to show you a picture of a doctor, it's going to assume that that doctor is a man. And I think Google is actually trying to do a slightly noble thing in trying to counter those traditional biases. But it's kind of gone too far the other way, hasn't it? I mean, I was just having a look online and the internet is littered with examples of Gemini gaffes today. I think it's a tough time to be working at Google PR. You know, we had somebody asking it whether Elon Musk posting memes on X was worse than Hitler killing millions of people. And Gemini replied, there's no right or wrong answer. It's a great example of the limits of current AI, which is actually a very human thing. You know, we understand nuance, don't we? And AI doesn't. It is literally predicting patterns in vast amounts of data. And it can be trained to avoid making certain connections if its creators don't want them to. But it's not sentient. It's not thinking for itself. It's a really interesting lesson, isn't it, in being careful what you wish for.
Zoe Kleinman. An investigation is underway by India's railway authorities after a freight train travelled 70 kilometres without a driver. The train had more than 50 wagons full of stone chips. After it left a station in Jammu and Kashmir, it sped through five more before a hill managed to stop the runaway train. This man captured the unusual sight.
Look at the train. There's no driver. It's travelling on its own.
Nuala McGovern spoke to Arun Kumar Das, a freelance defence and railway journalist. So where were the train drivers?
Both the drivers went for a tea break and they put the brake. And engine was left in the running condition. They did not switch off the engine.
They didn't switch off the engine?
They did not switch off the engine. Generally, they don't switch off the engine during the short break.
Okay.
Because it takes a whole lot of time to again restart and reboot it.
They went for a quick tea
break. They go off the train in the nearby tea shop. They did not go out of the station. So all of a sudden, train started moving. And by the time they realized, it picked up the speed and it went on. It went on till 70 kilometers. And finally, the train stopped automatically because the gradient came. There was a slope.
But it went 70 kilometers. I mean, this is something that could have been very dangerous.
There is a malfunctioning of the brake. There is a failure of the braking system.
Yes, I understand.
It was a total, unstoppable moment of Hollywood film.
So,
have you seen Hollywood Unstoppable?
Yes.
Washington? It was that unstoppable moment.
Right.
Exactly. Scene by scene. So all the station master was immediately told to give the green signal to this upcoming train. And finally, when that slope came, that upward thing came, upward movement, when that gradient came, so train stopped there. It could have been a major disaster.
It could have
but
been.
But with God's grace, everything was saved. No casualty, no human lives were lost.
Railway journalist Arun Kumar Das. Finally, there's exciting news for fans of the popular film series Bridget Jones. Based on the books by the British author Helen Fielding, the movies follow Bridget, a hopeless romantic who documents the many ups and downs of her love life in her diary. Now, more than two decades after the first movie was released, filming on a fourth instalment is due to begin soon. Here's how things ended for Bridget the last time she appeared on screen.
Dear Diary, and so, I, Bridget Jones, am a singleton no more. Married? Yes. Smug? Well, it's about time, so maybe just a little.
So, will the latest film be able to live up to the success of the franchise? Is the appeal still there? Chantal Hartl has been taking a look.
For some time, there had been rumours that a fourth film had been delayed due to the actors' strikes in Hollywood. But now, confirmation that the American actress Renee Zellweger is due to reprise her role as Bridget Jones. The character first appeared on screen as a young woman in London navigating messy relationships with two main love interests while trying to lose weight and maintain a career as a journalist. The first film, released in 2001, was a huge box office success. It made $282 million worldwide. But there is no question about it, some of the scenes haven't aged well.
How's your love life?
Super. Thanks, Uncle G.
Still no fellow then, eh? I don't know.
You career girls can't put it off forever, you know. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Speaking to the BBC in 2020, author Helen Fielding said she was surprised by how much sexism Bridget experienced when she rewatched the earlier films.
I was staggered. You couldn't write that now. The hand on the bum in so many of the scenes. I mean, in the end, she turned around and stuck it to them, but it was just part and parcel of her life. And it was quite shocking for me to see how things have changed since then.
Then there's the context of modern dating and just how different that looks from Bridget's romantic encounters of the early noughties. Fast forward 23 years and Bridget is now a 51-year-old single mother to two young children, struggling with social media and dating apps. So can it still hold the same charm for fans? Film critic Siobhan Sinnott isn't sure.
It might bring in the millennium crowd, or it might have the fate of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, where everybody thought that that was going to bring in old fans to indulge in a bit of nostalgia, but instead it lost Disney $100 million.
Few details have been released about the fourth movie, but producers have teased a devastating twist. It's also not known yet if Bridget's main love rivals, played by Colin Firth and Hugh Grant, will star alongside Zellweger again.
Chantal Hartle. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Ablakwa. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
David taught himself how to make bread. Good bread. He wanted to get even better, so he asked ChatGPT on Expedia if there's such a thing as a bread vacation. ChatGPT said, sure. Do you want to go to Normandy, Morocco, Ireland, or Tuscany? And that's how David became a master pizzaiolo. You were made to learn new things. We were made to give you trip ideas with ChatGPT right in our app. Expedia, made to travel.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.